This talk comes from www.euroleadershipresources.org. The European Leadership Forum is a bridge between local Christian leaders' needs and God's global resources. Hundreds of hours of key Christian thinking. Go to www.euroleadershipresources.org and sign up to receive details of more resources that can support your ministry.
I think we should start. People will come in, but otherwise, time is going. Is this you have it? You can have the voice. It works good. So I will say a welcome to everybody. It's the last day of the network on Christians in Society. This morning there will be two lectures, and my lecture is on Picasso. And you have an outline that's a bit wider, and you've heard that message before than what I will be able to give this morning, because there's much more. For instance, in the title of the announcement in the book, you read also a reference to The Human Stain, which is a well-known recent book of Philip Roth. But I do not go into that book. You can ask questions when we have time later on. There is so much to say about Picasso that if I take too much hay on my fork, we say that, then I lose it all. So I can better concentrate myself on Picasso. And here you have, this was the poster that was hanging on the World Exposition, where almost all of the works of Picasso were exposed in 1956 or something. So that poster is Picasso in the strength of his life, but also with some very characteristic sentences. I think about death all the time. She's the only woman who never leaves me. And Picasso and woman, that's a chapter in itself. And then painting is stronger than I am. It makes me do whatever I want. It wants. And these two quotes are very characteristic for Picasso. In a way, my lecture this morning connects with the lecture, the second lecture yesterday. That was the question was asked: is an artist a prophet? And is an artist a prophet? Is the title of the inaugural address of Hans Rookmaker when he became a professor in art history. I thought it's interesting to connect with that title the two lectures of the second one yesterday and the one today, because Rookmaker had a very clear answer. He said no. And he said no because he believed very much in the fact that the artist stands also in a tradition of craftsmanship. And I'm not going into the details of that. But he said no. But I would like to, in a way, to take away one misunderstanding, and that leads me to my main interest in Picasso. Because I take away a misunderstanding, the fact that Rookmaker said, no, an artist is not a prophet, did not mean that an artist is not very much, let me say, the mediator of a worldview. And in a way, that was Rookmaker's conviction very strongly. He felt that sometimes you need to look and to listen to the artist in order to understand your own age and to see what kind of worldview is expressed. And that is what he taught us. I'm a disciple of Rookmaker, although I'm not an artist. And my main interest is, in fact, in that field of How does this artist express the worldview? And that fits in with this whole conference, the European Apologetic Network. We would like people to understand their own age and their own time. And with a little warning to this conference, maybe we are focused sometimes too much still on the times of modernity and do not realize that we have in the meantime moved into what is called the age of postmodernity. And here Picasso comes in, because although Picasso lived and died in the last century, and he died in 1981, the books of Lyotard, which is the philosopher of postmodernism, the book on postmodernism appeared in 1984. So you would say, how can you ever use Picasso as the prophet, then in my sense of the word, mediator of a worldview, as a prophet of the of postmodernity? Well, I'll explain that when we look at him, because the main activity that we will do this morning is you and me together will look at his paintings, and I must beforehand apologize. I think these pictures are an insult to Picasso, and if he would sit here, he would walk out angry and say, how can you ever do that? Show a picture, a copy of me of that quality. Because yeah, I had to download them from internet, and you know, then they lose a lot of its quality. So in a way, I thought, but my audience this morning, of course they know Picasso already, so they have the real thing in mind, and it helps them to concentrate on the pictures to show a weak copy. But at least it's a help, and we can't talk about Picasso without looking at his work. So that is what I would like to do. I've made a choice of very characteristic things in his life that he made. Why I did choose Picasso is very simple. I went one time on a tour, took an airplane, had not an interesting book with me, and bought this book of Adriana Stassinopoulos Huffington. Maybe you've seen her before. She is a very good writer of all kind of biographies. Very well done. And she wrote a biography on Picasso, and I read that in the airplane. And the title is Creator and Destroyer. And there she wrote, the way Picasso wrestled existentially with the deepest conflicts of our century until they destroyed him, we'll see that, depressed me. Until I realized that the life of Picasso was not just the life of a gifted artist or a most complicated man, a fascinating man, who he certainly was, but that it was the autobiography of our 20th century, mirroring in his life and in his art all the turmoil of this century. And by embodying them, he became a cultural hero and the legendary personification of our tumultuous moment in time. Now that quote, and then the whole book that followed, inspired me to say I'll work on that. You're cool enough. If you get too hot, then just let me know. Let me turn it on again. So that was on Picasso, a general description. That is what I found to be very true. And what I would like to do this morning is just in a rough way go through his life and show some characteristic paintings, and in a way let you also make your conclusions. I am also very curious to hear you're more clever in art than I am, so you feel free to come to me with what you see in his paintings. And I begin first with an overview, this just short to refresh your knowledge about Picasso. He was born in the south of Spain, in Malaga, studied in Barcelona and Madrid, not very long, I must say, because quickly after his first year at the university where he studied art, he went to Barcelona, and that's a crucial part in his life. I come back on that later on. And then the different, you know, the different periods he had in his life, the blue period, the rose period, and then he developed his own style that is known under Cubism. After Cubism, he experimented. He became a famous man already earlier, but he's already since 1907 a famous painter, and in the 30s a very rich man already, and experiments with lots of types of art, sculpturing, paintings. He's a very creative personality. And then certainly a high point in his life is the painting of Guernica in 1937, which is there in New York, hanging, a huge painting. And then later on, he is the celebrated, rich painter, world famous. When he died, he left in 1973. Oh, I said 81, it's 73, even a bit earlier. When he died in 1973, he left behind 16,000 pieces of art. 16,000. A fortune of $170 million. All inherited by the same children that he never gave one penny. That's a very remarkable man, and we come to that later on. So, starting from here, this is a painting that a painting drawing he made. You think how old he was? Primary school, 7 years old. It's a remarkable thing. He was a miracle child. His father was also a teacher in art. And so from early youth, he was taught to paint, and he had a remarkable gift. He never painted in his youth, like here at primary school. He never painted or made a drawing like a child, because this is not childlike. This is very... And later on in his life, he painted all... His power was painting like a child. So then he turned back to this childlike... creations, but anyhow, this is just a little impression to make you a bit known to Picasso, who was a very gifted child. At the age of 13, he made his first big paintings, and his father was so impressed that he never touched himself the quast, the brush again. He said, "It's now my son." He had a problem, growing problem of conflict with his father, so that around 1900 he changed his name into the name of his mother. So Pablo is his first name, but Picasso is the name of his mother, and Ruiz is the name of his father, and he never used that name anymore. And that is part of his upbringing. In one way, it's a very double relationship he had with his father. In one way, his father was his educator. In another way, his father, the competitor and the enemy. And it's a very complex situation. He later on regretted that he did not really finish off the relationship with his father in a harmonious way. Anyhow, this is the beginning of his life. Because he was already at early time such a gifted artist, his father sent him as fast as he could to the school in Madrid. And here comes a very, that's one of the things that always intrigued me when I look to it again. When you look to this, would you ever say it's a painting of Picasso? No one would say. If I would show this, you would put it somewhere in art history, but not as a painting of Picasso. This is the Lord's Supper. It's a painting that was part of his training. It's This was the school out of which he came. Now, here comes something very interesting, and I hope you get the feeling of it. This is the, let's say, the modern tradition. This was a painting, and the next one I'll show too, that are paintings that symbolize the worldview of modernity, which is, of course, the Catholic religion in the south of Spain, with all its glamour and solemnity and also basic truth. But then the other painting is this, and that is called Science and Charity. The right man on the right, it is painted in 1897. It was in his first exposition. He was a boy of 15, 16 years when he made this. These paintings, also portraits, are amazing. You can, I mean, it would fit immediately in the line of Rembrandt, as far as I can see. And these are expressions of the dreams of modernity. And I like to show that to say, well, this is where Picasso came from. This is where the whole of Europe comes from. You see me already reading him against the background of the history of Europe. These are our roots. First, the Lord's Supper, the Christian faith, and then here the dreams, the ideals of modernity. At the right side, his father. It's the portrait of his father. Then in the middle, this very ill, sick woman. It was a prostitute he took from the street and asked to model. And then at the left, the nurse. So here you have the two pillars of modernity, which is charity and at the same time science, because they too are in a way the pillars of our civilization. That's where we come from. Science, of course, that will help us to be saved from immaturity, as Kant was talking about. So we see here that he stands with both of his feet in that tradition. The nurse at the left is a boy who modeled, but anyhow, that doesn't matter. Yeah, but you see the quality of a man painting from his tradition. 1897, he was 16 years old. From that moment on, he got bored at the school, the painting school in which he was, Academy of Art in Madrid, and he flipped out. That has a history. I can't, you see, I should limit myself. I can tell all the details, but I shouldn't do that. But the problem was that in this, standing in this tradition, especially the Catholic tradition, he had some very negative experiences in his school, where he saw a kind of hatred against the non-Christian. In his personal life, where his little sister, and that has always been very deep wound in his life, for a boy with these fresh impressions. He lost his little sister when she was about 8 years old. Conchita is her name. And he loved her so much. And she died. And and he said, Lord, if you heal her, I'll give up my gift of art, my painting gift, my artistic gift. But she died. But he didn't give up. And so there is always already there a built-in conflict with God himself. Then with the bad experiences he had in his Catholic surrounding, I do not go into detail, made him at the age of probably 60 years old a rebel. So he stepped out of this tradition, left it completely behind, and went to Barcelona. Now that's an interesting period here in Barcelona. This is a bit too far. This comes after this period in Barcelona, but I have it now on the line. This is what happened after Barcelona. Let me focus for a moment longer on this period in Barcelona. That was a wild period in his life. Now, he has always been a wild man, but that period was specifically wild. Hanging around, living promiscuous, contacting artists in the café, called, that's an interesting name, the Four Black Cats. That was the cafe he always visited. And you had there the modern experimental artists of the 20th century. They already came there together, young people, had expositions, had radical ideas, read Nietzsche on the Superman, he read it literally there, made up his mind, was very deeply influenced by Bakunin, a Russian philosopher, and the Russian philosopher had as his motto, as his adagium, the urge to destroy is at the same time the urge to create. And that was kind of philosophy with which Picasso could identify and work out. And now the amazing thing is, I discovered that in working through his life, there were two groups, the modernists and the postmodernists. Isn't that interesting? There was a postmodernist group of artists, and I will not go into the names of all these people, but you had then already this strange conflict. In a way, let's not fix on the name postmodern and modern, specifically not in art. Because, strangely enough, modern art, has been used as a label for what I would call postmodern art. So you have a strange mix of terminology. But what they meant with postmodern art was, you saw Charity in Science, that painting? Well, that was definitely left behind. And they were experimenting with life. And they were rebels, and all these things slowly came up that later on were born into a mentality of the whole of Europe. But they were the first radicals there in Barcelona from 1898 to 1902. And 1900, at that time he started to travel. When he was at that time very poor and unknown. Picasso made, after these Barcelona times, and always coming and going from Barcelona, three trips to Paris between 1900 and 1902. He finally moved there in 1904. And this is where he went through what is known as his blue period. So here he starts to paint on this new basis of what I call then postmodernism. During this time, he used mainly different shades of blue, and he portrayed the seedy parts of town, including beggars, alcoholics, prostitutes. In a way, that was his setting. That's what he lived in, that kind of dark part of Barcelona. And I show you this one painting from the blue period. Now, each of these paintings, you should watch carefully and not only just look sharply, but also what does it express? What does this express? What would be the central word if you see this?
Elegance.
Elegance. Yes, that's true. They are, in a way, they are in marble. They are figures, but they're all standing on themselves. Here they are on the beach. It should be a family, isn't it? With the son. Do you see how he has the hand? This. Do they look to each other?
No.
They are completely isolated. And then when you start looking to that, look how they stand. And then in marble, frozen. It is like the frozen fear of a lonely person who can't relate. Even not with the child who's standing there. And then the blue, Carl Gustav Jung wrote a great article on this painting. And he's saying it is a kind of, he felt an all-pervading sense of doom expressed in the blue. But blue was originally, from the tradition, heaven. But in the prison of Barcelona that Picasso visited out of curiosity, what kind of people are there? All the prisoners were dressed in blue. So for him, the blue of heaven is changed in this blue of being imprisoned in an icy world. That's And then there is a lot more about the blue, but I do not go into Carl Gustav Jung. He, He is talking about the moonlight and water and the blue of the Egyptian underworld. But anyhow, that moves too far. But here you have this characteristic. The blue period is a very unhappy period. If you look to the paintings at that time, he's left alone. He's wrestling with the basic questions of life and has nothing to hang on. And then after this period comes the period he moves to Paris, 1904-6, met Fernanda Oliver. That's the first woman that he really loved, who influenced the mood of his work from dark and gloomy blues to light and happy red and pinks, which led this period in time to be called the Rose period. At this time, he painted many pictures of a circus that he visited often during his stay in Paris. And so you see harlequins there and clowns and children playing with a ball, and there is red and yeah, is it joy? Is it joy? I always think of, is it not nihilism with a smile? The harlequin. Isn't the clown at the same time a sad figure? The clown is in the paintings of Picasso almost always a self-portrait. The clown is the man who stands remote from real life, but observes it and describes it and plays with it and can come across as maybe very humorous and joyful, and sometimes he is, but it's the other side is the sadness of the clown. This is the most famous painting in that time, The Family of Artists in 1905. And here I would like you to look at two. I'm sorry again that it's not sharp, but it gives at least some expression. But when you see this, look for a moment to it, but how it comes across to you. Alice put... start again first saying, well, they are all beautiful figures. And
grotesque.
Yeah, grotesque.
Yeah, the little boy's head is almost like an adult and he's looking kind of at a distance.
Yeah.
And his feet are
what's behind it there, that head of the boy?
Oh, that boy, yeah.
Carries something.
Yeah, an object. It's a trommel. A trommel?
A drum. A drum.
Do you see more objects?
Yeah. The girl had a face.
The girl had a face, and she. Yeah, and the face. Do they express something? Are they crucial in the story? In the painting, that he would say, yeah, of course, they need to be there. They tell you something about.
They're not looking directly at one another.
No. No, that's. You see, again, here, look how people are connected. Are they connected? No. I mean, if you would see such a group of people, meet them, what would happen if you would meet them? Out in the. What kind of landscape is this? Barren landscape, a moon landscape almost. And look in what direction they look.
Yeah.
And the one like that, Again, the frozenness of the blue period is still there. The objects do not tell a story. That's very consciously done. He could easily have given other objects in this thing. The purpose is not that the objects tell a story, which they do in a normal painting. The object is exactly the opposite. There is no story to be told. And the other thing is that in each painting, you have something that is central in the perspective. It works on something. It gives you, as they say, real art is like a little window on eternity, on something that has remaining value. Here, there is no, all perspective is lost. They stand all on their own feet. They are not connected. And here you touch And you check me whether I read too much in it. But here, I feel that this is a beautiful painting expressing the main characteristic of postmodernity. And that is what Lyotard mentioned as the loss of the meta-narrative. Here, no story is told. The central perspective is away. There is no coherence. They are disconnected. And you could also use the word that Schaeffer always used of postmodernity, the age of fragmentation. Yeah, but here we move too fast, because he's not yet in that. They are still the classical figures. And so.
All the feet that we see are in postures of ballet, like Degas.
Yeah.
With ballet shoes on.
That's true. Yeah, that is the aspect of the dancing and the clown and the central people. That clown is painted lots of time, the red one with his dress, a bit autobiography. And when you look to the red man, the clown, look, where is his second feet? Did you see that?
Foot.
Second feet, his foot.
It's
no, it's not there. It's like very consciously done.
Like his son.
He does leave out. You think you look to a balanced, complete portrait, but what art artist would ever leave out one foot?
But he left out a foot in the portrait of his son.
Where this here in this one?
When he painted his son, the Arlequin.
Oh.
There's only one
foot. Oh, that's interesting. That's a new thing. I look for the one foot next time, because that is a crucial thing in his painting too. It you know what it does? It brings you out of balance. And that's exactly what he wanted. There is something always, and that comes out later on, much harder, of aggression and of attacking the viewer. He hated people who thought, oh, art is so beautiful, let's look at it. And there are moments that he said, art is like a razor blade, it should cut you. And that aggression comes in the next period. This is the family of artists, 2x2 meter, marked the end of the rose and blue period in Picasso's work, still in a traditional style. And ask yourself, the central perspective, what are they looking at, how is their mutual contact? And very crucial, very interesting is that Rilke, the German well-known poet, that he was in the house where this painting was hanging in the period of around 1910, and he watched it many, many times, and it became part of his poetry, and on this painting, he made this sentence, but tell me, who are those wanderers, strangers in a lost world, like all of us are? Now, it's done in German, but in German it speaks so strong about the lostness of people who are wandering around, not knowing where this is all about, having no answers. The loss of the grand story of the real perspective. Then comes this period, we must move on, in 1906, Picasso moved to Gozel in Spain, where he changed his style. He worked on that, his own style, a long time. His new works were influenced by Greek, Iberian, and African art. And he began to use more geometrical figures in his artwork. Between 1908 and 1911, Picasso and Georges Braque, friends, painted landscape paintings in a new style. This style was termed cubism by a critic who described the work as being made of little cubes. They created this style by breaking down and analyzing the object. The main color scheme was browns and other muddy colors, monochromatic color. And you all have seen paintings of him like that, and of course the most well-known of these paintings is the La Demoiselle d'Avignon. He painted in a brothel in Barcelona, and The title Les Dames de Avignon is given to the painting by friends of him who saw it. So has no meaning in understanding the painting. And that's generally true. That is what Rookmak always taught me. The title should never be a key for explaining the painting. If the painting cannot explain itself, then it's a worthless painting. So this is the La Demoiselle Avignon. We look to it and we would say, oh yeah, these colors, and I would like to have it in my living room. But I can tell you, the first people who saw this were shocked, and especially those who were artists and who knew what it meant to paint. And so we are already a long time over the shock. And the shock of this painting is incredible, because everything what in the tradition of art should express beauty, and that is women, and then naked women is always a part of the symbol of beauty. Talking about art as a razor blade, well, this is what has happened here. And when his friends saw this for the first time, I'll give you some quotes. They were absolutely shocked by this, what they called act of violence. Everything, Picasso's own friends say, speaking, everything was hostile. The whole of creation. He painted here not to create art, pieces of art. He hated that word. But weapons. Defense weapons against the enchantment of the spirit that fills the creation. Spirit of beauty. And also offense weapons. Attack weapons against all outside men. Against each sense of belonging in this world. Against nature. Against human nature. Against who created this all. It's a destructive manifest. And that's all quote from his own friends. A destructive manifest, a rejection of life and creation that he saw as merciless, dark, rejectable reality with no hope, no beauty, damned and cursed. Now, if you look to it more carefully, then these, what do they express, these ladies? I mean, they are from the left to the right, it's an increasing line of expression instead of lust and beauty. Deconstruction and deformation. The figures seem to be cut with an axe. Eyes and mouth mock with all laws of nature. One face is like a dog's face. Another is demonic. All are like masks. The central face looks like being embedded in meat. And in fact, body is more meatier than beauty. And the right and the last one, I think, to the right, isn't that most tragic? Composed in pieces. It's one big fight against the myth of beauty. It hammers all things into pieces. Now, this style became the style of Picasso. To summarize, I come to that in a second. This style of Picasso, especially in the painting La Demoiselle d'Avignon, he made that also after visiting African art and being inspired by this African art. You see something of that in his paintings. But it became his style, I think, because it gave Picasso the form in which he could express what he felt. A world deconstructed. Think of the whole philosophy of deconstruction that followed up to Derrida late in the century. A world deconstructed in forms of observation. One could say here the child comes back. It's all kind of childish observation and expression. Flat, without perspective, primitive, one-dimensional, with a lot of room to reorder it in the way the painter wished. He could create a new world, be competitive with God, always fighting him. And at the same time, being struck by him. In the most famous painting of Guernica, later on, we see to what kind of art it has enabled him. Because that is one thing that I would like to throw in as a point of discussion with all of you, which can come up later on. And that is how amazing that that kind of art with that origin and that background, at the same time in the hand of a great artist, becomes like this. I mean, I can't show you the whole painting now as it is, it's smaller than that, but this same style has two faces. It can be used to express something very beautiful. I mean, this is also a cubist painting, but it has something. And paintings like that made him incredibly famous. I can show you some more, and then always the tension in his work of, I can paint like that, but not always. There are things I cannot paint in this way. He never painted himself in a cubist way. He never painted Olga in this way. Olga was his first wife. I said already the story of Picasso and his wives and women is incredible. Because in the meantime, he has had many others, but Olga was a Russian dancer in Paris. He met her when he made the scene behind on the stage, and he met her, fell in love with her. A beautiful lady, and he always paints her like this. And that's in the same time, the same Picasso. Schaeffer always feels that here comes out a real humanness. Man can rebel a lot, but he can never escape that he's created after the image of God. That's what Schaeffer say. And then it pops out in a painting like this. But also in a painting like this. Not this one, this one. If you look, this is a full-grown cubist painting of Picasso, but I love it. It's a beautiful painting, and it expresses so much what this form, how it enabled him to tell a story about this whole, these people that are playing the piano and playing the flute. We could spend half an hour on this, watching it and letting it tell its story. But it's well done, beautiful in the color, beautiful in its form. So here you see what I call the tension between, yeah, even in a style that's inspired by a worldview that's not ours and that's against God, still there is this not repressible gift of beauty and creativity that expresses itself in a marvelous way. Because it's an incredible painter. If you read his life, how he daily made, he was always painting. And if he had no money and he was in a restaurant, and then on the servette, he made a little drawing of a lady sitting there with a hat, and that was his payment for the food, and it was much more worth than all the food you could buy in the restaurant. But there are very beautiful films where he has shown how he did it. He can make in one line. He can create a world. It's an incredibly gifted man. Anyhow, I showed you this, but I showed you right before that, and I can't get it back now. This painting with Dora Maar. You saw it flashing around. It's many times. Well, this is another one, but not that bad. But you can find Dora Maar almost always on the top of his expositions, because it's one of the famous paintings of this distortedness. This art created enabled him at the same time to create, to portray anger, sadness, but also his aggression against the world as it is, in fact, and then specifically the world of beauty. Here you see another. They said, well, maybe Picasso was always involved with Christianity. It's a painting, the dance, but in that time he painted several paintings like that, and you would say it's a crucifixion, and this figure hanging. But although there is the dance, and although there are the colors and the composition and the beauty of that, at the same time, it doesn't express any respect for Jesus Christ dying for mankind, but Jesus Christ dying for mankind is in his paintings always the ultimate aggression. Look to a God, who saws his son in pieces. So there is always a rebellion against reality as it is, and where it's beautiful, it is part of his competition. He would like to be better than God. If you look back now for a moment, then I can say that what I've seen up to now, that is all typical characteristics of postmodernity, and that is the loss of the meta-narrative, isn't it? He's lost it. And the nihilism with a smile, that's how I would like to call postmodernism, because it's different than existentialism. The existentialism of Sartre is black, but postmodernity, you can laugh. Take the film of Jim Jarmusch, Down by Law. You laugh from the beginning to the end. It's completely irrational. And the whole, there is no story and no solution, and nevertheless you laugh. That's also a bit in the life of Picasso, this doubleness of anger, depression, isolation, combined with beauty, flavor, luxury. The man was rich up to the very end, and houses all over the place, going to the beach here, always working hard, eh? Always working hard. He never went really on a vacation. Even on the beach, he would. He was fascinated by painting or drawing or creating. An incredible creative person. Anyhow, we move on to this main work, Guernica. Guernica was a work that was done to express. They asked him to make this for the United Nations and to express his outrage at the German bombing of the Basque town of Guernica on April 26th. In 1937, during the Spanish Civil War. The painting is not a portrayal of the actual bombing, but a symbol of the act itself. It's not just a descriptive, but it's deeply symbolic. Here you see how a man like Picasso, with his style, could grow to really universal length and height, because it's a painting that's incredibly impressive. And yeah, because he had already this aggression, can you imagine? He could use all his aggressive talent in portraying the ugliness of war. And all people all over the world felt that this was exactly what this painting expressed. Now you see, this is a painting that could not hang in on two walls like that. I never saw it in reality, but it's a huge wall painting. And he himself said, you should read it from the right to the left. You, Rookmaker taught me always to read a painting from the left down to the top right. But here you should, he said you should do it the opposite around. It is in the classical form of a drieluik, a three, how do you call that? Triptych, yes. You know that they had these kind of paintings in the cathedral, the triptych, three paintings connected to each other, and that is how it is. You should cut it into three parts and look to it from the right to the left. And he worked on it very hard and had very many preceding attempts to do it. But what you see here, that is the result of destruction and the ultimate despair. How could he paint the ultimate despair in the mouth of a horse? I mean, look to the mouth of the horse, for instance. I mean, if you would like to express this ultimate despair, then what an artist to do it that way. But you see, the whole painting is expressing that. There at the right, the woman in despair when the bombs are falling and the body is broken and distorted are falling on the ground. And then this face of the dream of modernity, with having in its hand, you see the torch. Do you remember how the how when you go into New York, the sculpture is of the torch of freedom? And to what it leads, there is hanging on the ceiling the sun, But what is the result? It is the deception of total disillusionment as a result coming out of these ideals of modernity. And in the middle there, the horse, which is a symbol of Spain, and then in the left, you could say, yeah, the lady taking, you see her standing here to the left, having the child. It is like in a classical painting, taking Jesus off the cross. I mean, there's also this symbol reference to the history of painting in Europe.
Pieta.
The Pieta. And then the bull, which is the symbol for fascism, doing all this aggression. And each detail speaks the language of destruction in a beautiful way. Guernica, in deepest sense, it's a rejection of the creation without hope after the apocalypse. I think that's a good definition. I would love to see that painting one time and spend there for a day to look to all the detail, because I'm only one-tenth of the depth in this painting. When you read about it, and I always need people that give me some help in understanding the symbolism. The horse in the center, as we saw, is a symbol for Spain in its suffering. The Taurus at the left stands for the triumph of fascism and any man-made ideology, also this lady with the torch. The form is a triptych. The left one, a Pieta, in the middle, culture destroyed by war, human suffering, at the right, rage and despair. And then the eye, the torch of freedom. It's a very profound painting, and it made him more, even more famous in world history. Then came the Second World War. He was never in the war involved, and the story of his heroism is not very impressive, let me put it mildly. But after World War II, Picasso moved towards more somber death-like pictures. He painted an incredible lot. I'm not that much impressed by much of his painting after the Second World War. He married the painter, a young girl, Françoise Gillot. She was the only girl who could stand against him. And she had two children of him. And she divorced him. She said goodbye to him. He couldn't stand it, because in the whole way he related to woman was the same way he related to reality. Bring in control and destroy. And love it and destroy it. Creator and destroyer. And Claude and Paloma later on inherited lots of his fortune. And Claude, I'm impressed by her. She used a lot of that fortune for, works of charity. And then later on, I go fast. Later on, he met another woman named Jacqueline Rosk, whom he married in 1961, and he died in 73. And I show you some of his paintings. Here you see some of his paintings. Many of them are in this time, in the 60. This is 68. May sound strange, but it looks like a self-portrait of the painter to the right and the lady to the left. But it's more a peep show. It is brute, making the lady an object, as if he looks to it through these glasses in which you can get in Holland when you go to the Rose, the prostitute neighborhood in Amsterdam. And here, you would say, in earlier times, he could express the flavor of beauty. Of course, there is dynamic in the painting, but look to the black, and look to the... death is coming in and coming up. And Picasso, in his personal life, became more and more the angry old man. And the history of his relationship with his grandchildren is really very sad. I mean, he was, in fact, to be blamed for the death of his grandson, who came to him to after he lived in a huge property in a mansion, and his grandfather sent him away with the dogs behind him, and the boy couldn't stand it that his own grandfather didn't receive him in his house, and he did drink. He was very poor. His grandchildren were all very poor, and he did drink not gin but gin in a chemical way, and destroyed his whole stomach, and he died of that. Very sad story. What is this strange man that you have the millions there? His own granddaughter had to get a scholarship from someone else, and then when he died. When he died, all his fortune went to the same grandchildren. That's amazing. And this is the last self-portrait he made. So that is the life of Picasso. And I must say that I've left out a lot. It is just a rough outline of a human life. But now, coming back to where we started, this was Picasso. I think about death all the time. He's the only woman. She's the only woman who never leaves me, because death and women were the central themes. Death, sex, and God. That are the central themes in his life. But are they not the basic themes of literature and of the 20th century? And isn't Picasso himself a symbol of a mediator of a kind of way to relate to these things, which is characteristic for the 20th century, taking central two world wars and in Picasso's life, Guernica, and then looking to his paintings, you see him losing the grip, losing his faith, losing the foundation around 1898 in Barcelona, and then trying to develop his own style, first being very, very honest in expressing in the Blue and the Rose period the mood and the way he experienced life as it was, but in the meantime losing the all-over perspective. No truth, there is no truth, and no meta-narrative, no greater story, no perspective. We've seen it in his paintings. When you see it in his paintings, then you start to feel that this is, in a way, let's say, the roots, these are the springs out of which the European civilization in the 20th century is born. He not only he expressed it, but he embodied it. He lived it out with, on the one side, the luxury, and on the other side, the destruction, the inability to relate, always going to the limits. I heard that yesterday. That's typical for Picasso, too. In his sexuality, he always went to the ultimate, tried to get out of it what was there, tried to search. There must be somehow some kind of a secret behind this deep emotion that I've not yet discovered. And then experimenting with women in the same way as he experimented with his paintings, and trying to cut out, he has wounded women, and many of them a lot, never in finally able to really love the person in a stable relationship. So they all left him, except of course Jacqueline, who was there when he died, and she died. Committed suicide when he died, and he had said so. One of his sayings at the end of his life was, "I will be, I don't know the literal quote, but I can tell you, I will be like a sinking ship, and everyone who hangs on me, I will take with me to the abyss." I mean that, and that is what portrayed his final self-portrait. You can see that. That's where it ends. So that's Picasso. And of course, his real dream and power was painting. Painting is stronger than I am. It makes me do whatever I want. Now, when you see this all, I think, you can also draw out of that one line all the characteristics of postmodernity: the loss of the meta-narrative, nihilism with a smile, picking the fruits without the roots, the age of fragmentation, the loss of coherence, the immorality, looking to sexuality as a field where you can find the limits and going over the limits, promiscuity, playing with death, and the destruction. I mean, here you have a man who expressed what is alive in Europe in that strange 20th century. I hope we get a better one now. But anyhow, that was my introduction on Picasso. I could go on, but let's have still some minutes for you to react.
I think looking at Picasso, and with hindsight, he seems to be a very confused and a very confusing man. I think we see the beginning of postmodern value in his work, but there's still a lot of modern value left in there.
Yeah.
And I wonder if I could meet Picasso, why am I asking what he valued and what he valued inside of painting? Because meta-narrative is still there, still using the meta-narrative to paint. His paintings are very modern in style. There's a concern for composition, for that, for the vertical, for the horizontal, the flatness to the frame, all of which are very modern values.
Yeah.
So the vehicle he's using, the medium that he's using, is a very modern medium, but the ideas that he's expressing seem to be very postmodern.
Yeah.
So that, to me, with hindsight, seems to be confusing, but of course, at his time, we'd rather be groundbreaking.
Yeah.
If you meant the full hog, you might be more, you know, Marcel Duchamp with his urinal piece that moves away from all norms of art itself. It goes away from painting sculpture altogether.
Yeah.
It uses the ready-made object instead. And that was a real linchpin, a real starting point for postmodern art as well.
Yeah.
But I wonder if you see that confusion as well, and like how you might, what he might describe as values in his life.
Now, the thing is that he admired the work of others like Matisse. He loved and always the artistic jealousy, not acknowledging it, not praising that too much, because he was jealous of some other painters who could do very well. But I like that on the other side, that they could have a high value for people who painted in another style. And they were always living in a group, and they were always looking in Paris and in life, because to the work of the others, sometimes also blunt, discrediting it. Other times deeply admiring it, but realizing that they couldn't do it, but then trying to copy. It's always strange. Picasso had a time that he tried to copy the great classical painter, Rembrandt, and this whole painting, I forgot the title, Rubens, about one of the masterworks in paint. But they do that also of each other. They borrow from each other when they see something interesting they can do it too. But now coming to your question, I think Picasso is an example of a mixture. In many ways, he shows that he uses the gifts, the rules, play rules, and traditional ways of doing things. But what I admire in Picasso is that he can handle it all in a strange way. He can handle all these styles. If you would see, I think that's amazing for me, that someone can, he could have painted his whole life in the style of Rembrandt. On the other side, he couldn't, because there you see the point. That is that Rembrandt had a completely different worldview than so it doesn't express what is in him and what he really believes about reality. And then this mixture of the, let's say, influence of the classical tradition, using it, handling it, and then molding it in the way he wants to express what he wants to express. And that is what you see, a mixture of that. And I'm not, as I said, a real expert, but I would love to know names of people who would be more radical than Picasso is. And you would know them, Alice?
So when I look at Picasso, I feel an essential capturing of life.
Yeah.
Like in The Weeping Woman.
Yeah.
I don't know anything more sad than that Weeping Woman in all the world.
Yeah.
I look at that woman and I weep. I feel this incredible pain. It's somehow a genius that you can't capture. He captures this. There is a painting in Basel of Picasso that reminds me of my wife that I keep on the wall and that I carry with me in the luggage.
Yeah.
And it's a woman playing with the kitten. And she's lying on her side and she's slightly fatter than my wife is. Well, much fatter. And the kitten is sitting on her hip and she plays with the feather. And the kitten has six front feet.
I had in my last lecture much too many copies, paintings of Picasso, but several of them are marvelous to show. I did now, but this one I flipped over very fast. This is Dora Maar. Why did he like Dora Maar? Because she was utterly depressed. And now she was always in that mood. And then he loved it to paint her, but there is also something sick. That's what I feel. Also something sick here, because he not only played with that in compassion, but he didn't really help her out. He had at the same time another woman, and then he tried to set them up against each other in a cruel way. I mean, I'm not. He was trying out all things. Ugly and also beautiful and also charming, because if Picasso walked in, I've always imagined what would happen if Picasso walked in the room. If he would walk in the room, you would immediately be filled with it. The room would be filled with his presence. Yeah. He was a dominating person, but utterly charming to ladies. They all fell for him. He could say the words to be said. He could charm them and give them what they wanted. So he could play with life, and then he twisted it into something ugly because a relationship that would remain, so that he would be responsible, and so that maybe he would be attached in such a way that he couldn't get rid of it anymore. He couldn't stand that, and so. That happened with all of his women. But I came to that because of this painting. I mean, the painting is a cubist painting, but I do not object against the style. I think here the style does express exactly what is there. And I can see the girl, the lady there, with her sadness. And he could do that in many ways. He could do it in a classical way, and he could do it in this way. He could do it in a supernatural way, the girl with the tear. And that is more, not supernatural, but what is the word? Surrealistic. That's the word, surrealistic. He could play with all kinds of styles. And in that way, became, of course, a very famous man. Always in living in his world, that too. Anyhow, we have to come to an end. Anyone who has still a question? Yes?
One more question. Picasso's time in Paris around the turn of the century, what relationship would there be between Picasso's style and the literary style that came on the left bank of Paris in the 1920s? Is there any relationship between the two that you can detect?
You ask whether there is a relationship between the social embedding, setting of in Paris 1920 and Picasso's style.
Yes.
Now, it's already before 1920. The period in which he, in 1920, he had already houses on several places and he switched, but of course he lived many
times. The influence on, say, Hemingway, Fitzgerald, the writers, and in Paris, is there a relationship of cultural norms and atmosphere in Paris that came from Picasso that affected literary figures.
Yeah, now, I would say there is an interaction. He himself, by his painting, was one of the motive powers to set the promiscuity and to undermine faith in the modernity, in its ideals of charity and science. So he was part of the game. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, he was himself deeply influenced by that artistic setting. I don't know how deeply he was influenced by philosophers. I don't think later on he did read that much. He was always working, but the setting in Paris, already since 1902, when he went there, up to, in fact, the whole, up to the 1920, 1930, has deeply influenced him. His friends, they were always together, they were all sensitive of what kind of art could be sold easily, and they always had needed, of course, the finances. They had then the art critics. They talked about their work among each other, so there was this exchange, and that influenced him too. His political awareness, I have no high respect. He could switch easily pro or contra communism, depending on how much it favored his personal position. That's how you could say it. Not based on a real, like Sartre had convictions and could stand for it. But Picasso played with that too. And always played it in such a way that he stayed out of the risk. And there are stories connected with that. Not always pleasant stories. And so he was a strange and remarkable man, always involved in art, and never, let's say, an authority in his opinion on politics or social life, or that what I read of it meant nothing. Anyhow, we have to have a break, so thank you for the attention.